presents Scratch a Track,
the podcast where we debate which track to scratch off some of the most known and unknown albums of all time.
We live in an era of singles.
This is an album.
People no longer listen to an album for the work it truly is.
It kind of defines a man.
It's just not something that people relate to nowadays.
We've all gotten the dreaded.
Started out as a game.
Which track on the album would you scratch out if you had to?
Hey everyone, welcome to another exciting episode of the Scratch the Track podcast presented by the Dune Grim Show and co-produced by Mr. IVEST. I am the Dude.
And I am Grim.
And today we are going to discuss Verses by Pearl Jam. Dude, I wish I could hold up the CD of this. I believe I had it.
Yeah.
Don't know where it ran off to. I know you had it too, because I remember listening to it.
I don't think I did.
Really?
Oh, I think I may have a burned copy of it at some
point. Oh, okay.
I don't think I had, you know, the original. I had a copy of my second draft.
According to Hoyle Miracle, yeah, that it was. Yes. Now, one thing that I never thought of, I guess, which is kind of ignorant, but I never really thought about it with this album, but I mean, dude, they had some pretty big shoes to fill trying to follow up 10.
Yeah, they kind of did. And a lot of people will have trouble with that. You know, their sophomore album sometimes can, you know, they do call a sophomore slump, right? Because, you know, the debut album, they've been working on those songs and polishing them, and they just like throw their whole hearts into it. And then a lot of times the record company or, you know, whoever wants them to get something out, right? So they're really kind of forced to put something out and, you know, potentially could maybe, you could say, sacrifice a little creativeness just to get something else out. A couple filler songs maybe, but they had a full 2 years in between 10 and this.
Granted, they were probably on the road the whole time. Now, there is a comment made by a fan of the show, Mac, that I guess is a quote of something else, but I thought it was a really poignant quote that especially stands here. And the quote is, "You got your whole life to write your first album."
Right.
That's a really good, interesting way to look at it, I think, because truly you do in a lot of cases, unless, you know, you're someone like Elliott Smith, who just had like this stockpile of songs that he was just waiting to record. A lot of people may not have that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to kind of say it. And a lot of those bands will, for the debut album, you know, they've been working on those songs for years and years, and they're just polishing them. Now, with this one, it even, from everything that I read, it didn't even really sound like while they were on tour for 10 or anything, they were playing a lot of these songs. It sounds like they really went into the studio with their first time working with Brendan O'Brien, who's a great producer, has produced a bunch of their stuff, STP, and we've seen him as an engineer with a lot of Rick Rubin stuff as well.
Yeah.
In that Red Hot Chili Peppers documentary, I believe.
Oh, that's, yeah, he was engineer on Blood Sugar
Sex Magic.
And, you know, just happened to be in the neighborhood. So when Bob Dylan did his MTV Unplugged, he just played Hammond organ because he was around, so...
Yeah.
You know, that's cool too.
That's what I do. Well, another thing that I found out was interesting was, and correct me on his name, Dave Abbruzzese.
Yeah.
Is that it? Okay. Like, he just came in because there was it David Cruz who was, or Cruz? I don't know. He was their drummer in the studio on 10, but after 10, he checked himself into rehab. He had some personal problems and was battling alcoholism. So Abbruzzese came in. He did the 10 tour with them.
And, dude,
so that would be interesting, though. Like, can you imagine, though, touring with a band for 10 years on an album that you did record on and then going into the studio and saying, you know, hey, now we're going to start recording together. That's not a common story. I don't think I've really ever heard before.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, one thing I will say, is what a really good way to like become a band, even more so than recording an album together, because
a lot of camaraderie there,
and just being and just having to do that stuff, like, you know, day in and day out. And now, dude, they've had Pearl Jam has had their fair share of drummers.
They've had some people in and out. I think.
Yeah, because you mentioned Dave Crewson.
Cruz.
Matt Chamberlain jumped in there real quick. And then Abruzzese, it looks, was in there for about a solid, I don't know, 3.5 years. Jack Irons, and then Matt Cameron came in and looks like about 98-ish. And I believe he also played with Soundgarden. And but he, I think he remained their drummer for... until now, like, still plays with them.
Yeah, see, I thought Matt Cameron also was... He was, like, deciding between Soundgarden or Pearl Jam. I could have all this wrong. But I thought I read that he was also considering... he was in between bands at the time.
I don't know. But, I mean... I believe
Matt Cameron. I don't know. There's a Matt Cameron and a Matt Chamberlain. Sorry. I'm getting all these mixed up.
Oh, no, this is Cameron. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But I don't know. That's kind of interesting. And I wonder if that had any, I'd like to look. Oh yeah. So Matt Cameron was also in Temple of the Dog. So you had a lot of people from Soundgarden and Pearl Jam in Temple of the Dog.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, they're definitely in and out. So I'm looking at Matt Cameron's page, and he started with Soundgarden in 1986, and then I guess he appeared in each of the band's studio albums until they broke up in 97. In 98, Cameron was invited to join Pearl Jam's U.S. Yield Tour, and then became a permanent member of the band. And then 2010, simultaneously kind of double. A member of Pearl Jam and Soundgarden. So, dude, it's kind of like Spinal Tap. You know, there's some people in and out, right?
Yeah, yep. And he wasn't the one who ended up as a globule. That's pretty awesome. I mean, just to be able to say, like, yeah, just so my resume is basically that I was the drummer for two of the biggest bands in the 90s, kind of grunge era. So, you know, if you just want to give me my corporate card and the other effects I'll need to work.
Oh, wow. Dude, he even played with Queens of the Stone Age in 90, they're saying 96 through 98.
Wow.
So, yeah, not so bad.
Yeah, that's so pretty bad. Cool.
All right. Anyways, glad we got all that sorted out. And I know all of our fans out there, after they go ahead and
subscribe and comment below,
correct us and tell us exactly where we went wrong with all of the names, how to pronounce them, and who is drumming for who and at what time and where.
Yeah.
So please go ahead and do that.
I got to ask you, because there'll be talk of this and when we get to like critical reviews and all that stuff, but where do you rank this versus 10? Where do you rank this album in terms of your favorite Pearl Jam album?
You know, I definitely rank it up there because it has some of my, you know, some of my favorite songs on it of Pearl Jam's. It's hard, man, because it's different than 10, and 10 was probably, I don't know, 10 just, that's like the first one I heard, and you know what I mean? And there's just a lot of those songs just have, I think, sort of special meaning, I guess. And I can, I just remember certain times and listening to those songs. Remember last year we did that episode on Vitalogy.
And, I know. Vitalogy is a really good one.
Man. And I kind of feel like they're all so different. I feel like 10 is a little more
accessible.
How do I say it without being insulting? Factory a little bit.
Yeah.
Maybe like it's like there are some weird songs definitely on Vitalogy. And then there's some songs on Verses which aren't as you know, formulaic. I guess I shouldn't say factory. I should say formulaic a little bit. And, you know, Ten's got those, it's got those big hits. It has the music videos. They didn't do any music videos for the Versus album.
I'm glad you brought that up. That was one thing I wanted to bring up, too, because it, and part of it was riding off of the success of how popular the Jeremy video was, I guess.
Right. Well, and I think I forget. It might have been Stone Gossard who said, he was like, you know what? 10 years from now, I don't want people remembering the song as a video.
I thought that was a pretty interesting quote.
Kind of in those terms. And that it is funny to think about it in those terms, because sometimes you're like, man, you know, would you remember the song? I'm not saying for any Pearl Jam stuff, but for some bands, would you remember the song as much
if
it didn't have the video to go along with
it? Well, we even wrestled with doing a segment on the show that clearly our fans have been so supportive of our other offshoot segments of videos that made the song. Because, dude, there's some of them that you just become so entrenched with each other, you can't think of them separately.
Well, let me ask you, Graham, because you just asked me a question, and I thought about this for a spinoff episode. We did have sort of like, you know, the covers face off. We could potentially do some sort of a thing where there's like an album's face off. All right, let's face off 10 versus versus. 10 versus versus. I mean, come on.
Yeah, you're already kind of
10 versus Vitalogy. I mean, who knows where that could go. But, you know, it is cool when you can kind of pit, you know, albums against each other a little bit, because again, it makes for fun conversation and debate and whatnot, and it pisses people off too.
Oh, it does.
You don't know what you're talking about.
So, and here comes some more of that. I like this album a lot more than 10. I think this might actually be my favorite of their albums.
Interesting.
There's just so many good songs I like. I just, like you said, it was a lot more formulaic with 10, but this just has a rawness to it in a lot of it that I really like. And in just exploring some spaces. Now, it's been said, especially of the song Blood, I believe, and I think maybe parts and Rats, that they were going into funk.
Funk, yeah.
I don't know. And far be it for me to say, because as some asshole commented once, like, what are these two white guys doing talking about funk? But in this case, dude, I'm sorry. Like, I understand that adds an element of funk, but it ain't exactly like listening to, you know, Funkadelic or something.
No, not at all. Yeah, and there is a few songs, and when we get into the tracks a little bit, that I'm like, okay, I got a little funk here and a little funk there, and Rats was one of those, especially the intro to Rats has a very funky kind of feel.
It's like, just because you put Wah on something does not mean it's funk.
It might make it red. Oh, yeah. Do a little scratch guitar, and that means it's reggae. Yeah. You know, certainly. You know, now, yeah, so this was the first that they did with Brendan O'Brien. I didn't see who produced 10, or I neglected to look that up, but it's interesting that they went with, you know, I don't know, that was such a successful album that they're like, hey, we're going to go with someone else. And I imagine at that point, Brendan was kind of breaking out as his own and in getting, having a good start. Cause I think he had worked with, what's our buddy again? I forget it.
Ruben
for some time, and I think he was ready to branch out. And I find it interesting though that he's working with like STP and he's working with Pearl Jam, and if you're that good, but you know, people sort of, you know, compared those two bands a lot, especially Core and 10. I know STP got a little flack for trying to sound like Pearl Jam at times. And it's just interesting that, you know, it's like, oh, well, we do have the same producer, maybe not on Core. I don't know if he'd.
But you know what's funny, and I was thinking about this, is I think you could argue that there are some producers who have a sound, like Phil Spector had the Wall of Sound, right? Like, dude, Friedman has kind of a sound. You know what I mean? But I guess I don't think that about Brendan O'Brien necessarily, and I think that's a really good quality because the band is the sound. He as a producer doesn't necessarily have a sound. He just brings out the best in what they can do. Right?
It's definitely. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, he certainly does. And I feel like this album in itself, I mean, of course you can say an album has a sound.
Yeah.
But the songs are, they vary a lot on this album. And mm-hmm. some of, again, one of the things I do like about Eddie Vedder as a vocalist is he can change his voice and vocals up. I know we talk about Robert Plant and Roger Daltrey as being able to have like this
primal
scream. He does it too, but in a very more guttural kind of raspy way. But then, you know, but then he can sing very pleasant and kind of sweet too at times. And I really like the way he, you know, he's able to change up his voice. It's pretty cool. There was, gosh, what was it? I was looking at something, and I can't find it now, but, yeah. So now let me ask you this. This came out in 93, and when it came out, it sold the most copies at that point in history for the first 5 days, for the first week.
Yeah.
Were you one of those people who went, and do you remember when you got it? Okay.
No.
Okay.
Dude, I was 12 years old. So my ability to just like be there exactly when it came out was just a little more limited than it would be today.
Yeah. You were probably grounded that week.
There's a distinct possibility of that. Now, we were talking about some of the recording process, and there's a pretty good amount out here about that. And one thing I like is that they approach this by recording one song at a time. And they would mix the songs after they recorded it. And I was like,
right.
I can see where that would actually be a better way to go, because you get to a point if you're working on a project like an album where you have like you have all the songs, but you can just make a list after list, and this needs this and this and this needs this and this and this needs this and this, and then I gotta mix them.
Yeah.
You know,
I read that and also they kind of just with this album, they went into the studio, and we've seen bands do this. They go into the studio and they just kind of like figure it out and do jams and whatnot. And sometimes that can not be productive and lead to bands almost breaking up. It doesn't sound like that really happened here. But it, you know, as opposed to some bands will try new stuff on the road, and that allows them to songs to evolve. And we've talked about that a little bit, but even Stone Gossard said they were still able to do that in the studio, letting the songs evolve and whatnot. And, you know, Eddie Vedder would start singing and whatever. And that's where
they would react kind of work in to transitions his,
and stuff. Yeah. So that's a very interesting kind of way to go about it.
I thought that was cool too, because, I don't know, it kind of goes with this whole idea of using the voice as an instrument, because if an instrument can trigger some sort of a change in the mood or a transition within a song, well then the voice should too. So I thought that was cool that they,
right.
They were kind of that in tune.
Right. Well, they started recording, like they said, in the first week, they recorded like, what was it? Go, Blood, Rats, and Leash. And then all of a sudden they just kind of like hit a wall. And Eddie Vedder was really struggling. Not necessarily, I don't know if it was writer's block or creative block, but they said like the studio and where they were, it was too comfortable.
Tranquil, yeah.
So he felt uncomfortable. He's like, yeah, it just like wasn't him and he didn't like it. And then I heard that he like ended up sleeping in his truck, like in San Francisco or
just
something
so he
like
could,
that.
Yeah.
Like get away and like get more back to, I think kind of his roots. And, you know, I found that really interesting to read, but even kind of going back to like his vocals a little bit in his lyrics, there's one thing about him that I feel, and I think it kind of relates to this and him feeling comfortable. I feel like he's a very emotional person, and he's also, I think, a very honest person. And, you know, he'll stand up for himself and his beliefs, and it seemed like he would, you know, kind of, you know, screw Ticketmaster, screw the record companies. We're not putting out music videos. Like, even with Vitalogy, they were talking about almost intentionally making it not want, they didn't want it to sound good, right? Yeah. They were like, we are going to make a non-commercial record, kind of like Nirvana sort of wanted to
do. Yeah, within Utero, right? Yeah.
Yeah, they're like, yeah, we're, and I'm sure the record company just loved to hear that. But so that's one thing. I just feel like Eddie Vedder, he just sings, like, he's so, so honest, and it's a true representation of him and kind of how he feels and what he's singing about. It just really mirrors who he is as a person. So,
yeah. Oh, well, I think that's pretty interesting. I would agree. I think as far as straight lead singers, and now I believe by this time, and I don't mean by this time when they did this album, by this time now, I want to say when we saw him live, he was playing guitar a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't know if he could, or he just wasn't confident in his abilities at this time or what, but
I think there was one song, and once we get to it in my notes here as we're going through the tracks, I think they did say it was either his first, whatever, the first track that he actually played electric guitar on was on this album.
Oh.
And it's one of these, I think. You know, that's not to say that he didn't do it before or did it live, but I think, like, I don't know if he actually played guitar on any of the songs on 10.
Rhythm guitar on Rearview Mirror and Elderly Woman Behind the Counter of in a Small Town.
Yeah, Small Town. There we go. So what do you think, Graham? Should we get into the tracks?
Before we do, one thing that we've touched on in the past, and I always like to talk about, is aside from the sales, release and reception and what people had to say about it.
Mm-hmm.
Most people gave this album pretty high marks. Rolling Stone gave it 4.5 out of 5. Most things are in that range. Pitchfork only gave it a 7.6 out of 10.
Okay.
That's pretty weak in my opinion. I'm sure they gave whatever new indie white person with a drum machine 10 out of 10 because it's so amazing. But at the time, I guess this was not thought as amazing. The one that really got me was a writer, I think it was for the Village Voice maybe, but he basically said that, he gave them credit for the album not sounding like a carbon copy of 10. However,
wait, I read that.
Yeah. And then, it goes on to say, that Versus confirms once and for all that there's nothing underground or alternative about Pearl Jam. And some other dickhead from the Village Voice gave it a dud rating, which I think I don't get it. Like, at the time this came out and the sound of it, like, I don't know what rock these idiots were living under that would have made them think that it wasn't. I mean, it was so perfect in the time it was released. And this is like kind of early, you know, because not everyone knew about like some of the serious underground grunge back then, because sure, you just didn't know about all that stuff. But to all you people, I have to say,
what the fuck is that shit?
Yeah, I mean, I find it interesting that, you know, someone would kind of commend them for not making, you know, 10 times 2.
And then shit on the record.
Yeah. I mean, I will say they do go into some different places. There are maybe some, I don't know if I say some tracks that are, I mean, yeah, there's some certain things that maybe aren't quite as accessible as 10, but there's also a bunch of tracks that are, and there's some tracks that are just really, really good. I think this album just has very good contrast to
it. Yeah, I've always really liked it for that.
You know, You know, I mean, when you have daughter songs like Daughter and Elderly Woman, but then Go and Dissonant.
Yeah.
And those types of songs. Like, man, I don't know, dude. They did go some places and you really got to give them credit for that.
Yeah. So. And even in terms of the content of the songwriting, I think is a lot more, at least from what I can tell, is just more varied and kind of they seem to have a lot to say. But I think it's, I don't know. I've always liked the record, and let's get into the songs.
Let's get into the songs.
Oh, what do you think of the cover?
Oh, I think it's okay. I think it's fine. I mean, I think it's cool that, you know, Jeff Emmett like took the photo and everything. I think it's just kind of goofy and silly. And I think there's a part of me, I mean, I get what they were trying to say.
Yeah. 'Cause
he was like, you know, we were slaves and, you know, we're being held, all this stuff and kind of making a statement. But part of me is just almost like, it kind of goes along with not doing music videos. Like, hey, we're just going to throw something silly on there. And it's not going to, you know, it has meaning, but it kind of, you know, it's not something like beautiful. It's not like, you know, one that, you know, it's going to win album cover of the year. You know, it's like Dark Side that's just going to go down
in history. This iconic cover. I agree.
You know, they were like, you know, it doesn't really matter. Listen to the music.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of maybe sort of also a point they were kind of making.
Yeah.
So, first track, number one, Go. Also the first single of the album.
Yeah, I think that would have been my choice to release first as a single. I've always, I think it's a really good song. I love how it just comes out swinging.
Yeah, it kind of does. I mean, initially it has that almost like this little, them kind of like working out. Mm-hmm. You can see them because how these songs develop from jams a little bit, how, you know, the intro is kind of like that. And then boom, it gets into it. But the thing that I found that was interesting was that drummer, Dave Abruzzese, he's the one who he was playing it. Like he's the one who came up with it. He was like kind of playing it on acoustic guitar. And then Stone Gossard was like, hey, what is that you're playing? And then he just kind of like took over, and then, you know, the song grew from there.
Yeah, but really cool.
I thought that was interesting because with a lot of bands, you know, we know like Eric Kretz, like he's the one responsible for writing Tripping on a Hole in a Paper Heart. I feel like sometimes the drummers, people just think of them as
like they don't know how to play other instruments.
Yeah, they're just drummers, and that's what they do.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty cool.
Animal,
not to be accused, albums of the same names, songs, not pluralized. No,
I like that idea for a spin-off. Albums of the same names as songs, not plural,
not plural. Sweet. Anyways, so dude, this was the third single from the album, and initially it started off as an instrumental, like a demo called Weird A. And there has been, I think, a little, I don't say controversy, but people have, you know, as they will, you will look for a deeper meaning into lyrics.
Oh.
Some people said it was like the hatred towards media. Other people thought it was potentially like some sort of gang rape, which does not sound great. But essentially, dude, Eddie Vedder said, I guess in an interview, he was like, I don't want to talk about it. You know, like who the anger is directed at. He's like, it's not so much personal. It's just, well, some person at the record company said the other day that they wanted the vocals turned up. He wanted people to understand exactly what I was singing. So I told him what it was about. And he said, you're right. Let's leave the vocals as they are. Maybe we don't want people to understand it.
Oh, that's funny.
I think the record executive was probably just concerned that the bass was taking away from the vocals. That's probably sure.
For sure. A really common problem.
Yeah. You know, one thing I did know in, I think it was this song and actually in Go, you know, the guitar, like the, not even just electric guitar solos, dude, they shred on these songs.
Oh yeah. Right?
Not in a very different way than like
soloing.
Than they did on that album. Like like it, I was amazed. Like maybe I just didn't pay attention to it that closely when I listened to it before, but I was like, wow, man, they're just shredding
up. I do like the guitar parts, and I've always felt like Gossard and McCready have a really good way of playing off of each other. And the parts work really interesting together most times.
No, I'm with you for there, for sure. Daughter.
Now, I guess I always would have thought this was the biggest single off the album.
You know, I
remember hearing this song more than the other ones because, I mean, back then you still listened to the radio.
Yeah. Yep. This is the one that stood out to me the most on the radio from this album.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And it's, you know, once I started, you know, you listen to the lyrics a little bit, but then you kind of dig deeper.
Yeah, so it's one of those things where he writes in a really good way, but it's not an obvious way.
Definitely.
You know, you got to kind of pull meanings out of there. And even reading this, I would have guessed that it had some sort of a feel, but I didn't realize that it was about like a girl with a learning disability who was abused by her parents.
Yeah, he does some interesting things with his lyrics where they're not, certainly not, you know, very, always direct, like, hey, this is what this song is about.
He
doesn't just always spell it out. At the same time, I don't want to say he doesn't use metaphors, but things are just the way he verbalizes things and constructs lyrics together to tell a story is sort of very different than I think I've heard maybe any other musician or lyricist.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously there's, you know, a lot of great ones out there. I put him up there in it, but he's very, very unique, in how he does it.
Now, dude, one of my favorite parts of this whole album is at the end of Daughter, where everything starts to fade away and it almost has like this Middle Eastern sound where they're kind of like clapping with it. And it's very, very short, but I love that they go into that. And that is one of my favorite sounds.
Yeah, no, it is. It's cool. And you know, you probably wouldn't expect it initially when the song starts.
Yeah.
But it's sort of kind of go in that direction.
And unfortunately you never heard that really on the radio. So it's always a treat when you listen to it the real way.
Yeah.
Cause they would cut that off for sure.
Get into the commercial, the next track, just kind of crossfade that. Glorified G.
I've always found this title weird. Now I think you could understand what it was about because that line glorified version of a pellet gun was always pretty clear.
Yeah.
And in got a gun fact, I got to, but that's okay, man. Cause I love God.
Yeah. You know? But the one thing I did like kind of reading about it that I didn't know, it was, you know, obviously, you know, it's mocking gun enthusiasts, but it was inspired about Abruzzese coming in and telling the band, hey, I just bought two guns.
Yeah.
And it just kind of sparked that conversation with the band and everything. And I think the song kind of came out of that.
Well, I know. And it's nice how he teases that too, because he says, got a gun fact, I got two. Like that's kind of a nice little jab.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's kind of funny too, because when they're saying, you know, or a pellet gun, right?
Yeah.
Is it so? Because you think of a glorified pellet gun. I mean, dude, that's got to be pretty weird. Like, what's that going to stop?
Yeah.
In a sense, so it's kind of like, oh, you think you're just like this big man or, you know, badass because you have a gun.
That's what he says. Feels so manly when armed.
Right.
And it's funny to me how this came out when dude, like almost 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And God, that's really strange now to think about that. But it's strange that between this and some of the conversations that we'll get to in other songs about like race, how these same topics are so relevant today. Maybe more so than they were then. Actually, I would say definitely more so, because this was before like school shootings and really just shootings in general were like normalized in our society.
Yeah, like you had seen it. Well, obviously, there's what the Jeremy video, or there's like an alternative video, Basketball Diaries. You'd seen, but Columbine hadn't happened yet.
Hadn't happened.
And you know, I do forget exactly what year that was, but
99.
Yeah, it was at 99.
I think. Okay.
So it is interesting that a lot of this stuff is still it's still in our culture.
Yeah.
You know, as much as shit changes, it just kind of stays the same. I mean, we were talking about Do the Right Thing the other day, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, that's movies in the mid-80s or something. It's
it would be even more relevant now than it was then.
Yeah. So, okay. Track number 6.
Dissident.
W-M-A.
Dissident.
5. Dissident. Bro. Yeah, I'm skipping it. I know. Skipping. Sorry. Dude, you know, I was trying to think.
This was on the radio quite a bit too.
Yeah, this one was.
I remember this a lot.
This was definitely on the radio too. I remember it a lot. This one might be one of my favorites on the album. I don't know if it's my favorite, but it's up there. I really liked it. You know, I there's something about I like the way he sings it at parts and everything. It's got a great opening riff.
Yeah.
I even said, you know, when I was listening to it, and for some reason I was kind of comparing this album to 10 a little bit, just because, you know, I was trying to bring myself back in that time period, and they were talking about how they wanted this album to sound so much different. I actually feel like this is as close as they get. Yeah, it does.
Okay.
It has that sound to me.
Yeah, I'd say probably closer than anything else, to be fair.
Yep.
Yeah. But this is another one, I guess, on the that tells a story, as opposed to just being commentary. And I've always found the story very strange and interesting, like about some woman taking in a political dissident seeking asylum, and then she fucking turns him in the end.
Yeah. And then she like feels bad about it or something. Yeah, it was just like, just kind of weird.
Dude, escape is never the safest bet, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what he says.
Exactly.
Safe is bad.
All right, moving on to WMA. Okay, now I got a question. First of all, what does that stand for? I don't know,
dude.
Does anybody? You guys tell us.
Please. Yeah, please.
Somebody out there has to know.
Like, you know, after you like, subscribe, tell us what WMA means.
Yep. Because I'm sure you read this, that it was kind of inspired by he was a black friend with him. Came to the studio, and then there was, I guess, some cops or police officers outside the studio who started hassling him.
Yeah,
like okay. I mean, first of all, you know, one, you shouldn't do that, but also, like, hey, he's with Eddie Vedder. Like, it's okay.
You know, it's very possible, and not that any of this makes it okay, because that is not the point of what I'm saying. But it's interesting because at that time, I don't think like everyone in the world knew who Eddie Vedder was. Now, granted, a lot of people did, but like you know, like Officer Kaharski or whatever out there on the beat may not have known about Eddie Vedder and Pearl Jam.
Yeah.
He's probably still driving around his cruiser being like, God damn it, when is the new Motley Crue album going to drop?
Or he just pulled over a tour bus on his way to Chicago. Doing body cavity searches.
Who knows,
it's hard to say.
I really like the percussion on this song. The percussion is and I say percussion, I mean it's a lot of drum set, but the way that he's playing the drums is so different than, you know, just, it's not like your standard kind of rock beat. It's just a really nice departure. And it's Abrazzisi and Jeff Ament are the ones who are credited with this song. And I could see this being like just the bass player and the drummer, like coming up with this. And
it has this weird sort of maybe stripped down feeling a little bit. And then, but the drums and it has almost this tribal.
Kind of
beat to it. And I also noticed like the vocals and the percussion have this distance and space, you know, in the way it's like recorded and produced.
Yeah. So
this song to me really stands out on the album.
Agreed.
It is very, very different. Track number 7.
Blood.
Blood.
This is where they're going to get a little funky, right?
Yeah, and
or at least what you know, people consider funk and assholes yeah, like us. What do we know?
That's that. You know, I wouldn't say they're you know, like they're moving in on like the Red Hot Chili Peppers turf.
Yeah, I was gonna. That was gonna be my point too. I don't think like Stevie Wonder and George Clinton heard this and were like, shit.
Yeah, like, well, we better do something new. Yeah. No, I don't think so. But yeah, this to me, and I didn't really realize that until I started kind of listening to the lyrics a little closer. I guess maybe I just never paid as closely attention closely enough to this song. But it's really like being about the media and how the media kind of misconstrues things and kind of pulls you apart and everything.
Paint
the pictures. Me plow.
Yeah.
Me plow. But dude, I love the lyric, paint Ed big, turn Ed into one of his enemies.
Yeah.
It's just like, that's exactly what, like, you know, especially if you're a celebrity. And, I know he definitely had sort of a, I don't even know if I want to say a love hate relationship with the media, probably at this point in his career, more of a hate relationship. They didn't want to do interviews. They had nothing to do with it. So,
which was an interesting kind of way to go about like promoting this album was by not really promoting it. And then it ended up being the biggest seller until, you know, thank God Garth Brooks had to F that up. So with some probably really great music, but
it's a double live album, man. That's what the world needs.
Jesus. boy, it's a special fucking moment in life right there.
Oh, kicking the
all right
well
my favorite song on the album,
really
dropping it. Yep.
Ooh,
rear view mirror, okay, dude.
Well, I will let you take the lead on this one. Why is that specifically?
I don't know. I think it's for a lot of reasons we've already talked about, is I think the song has some pretty distinct parts that are very different from each other. And as I listen to the guitar playing on it, which I like, it's one of those songs that I've just always, it's always interested me where I'm like, man, how did you come up with that riff? Not the da-da-da-da-da-da, that part's kind of easy, but I really like the chord changes where he's in like the verses, you know?
Well, it's funny because they said, you know, this is one of those songs where it was one of the first to feature Eddie Vedder on guitar.
Yeah.
And he said, and Stone Gossard even said, you know, the band just kind of played it as Eddie wrote it. So, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, you could attribute a lot of that probably to him for this one.
Yeah. And maybe they played it with a little more finesse. I mean, he could be an excellent guitar player, but it's just, I don't know.
Yeah, that's not something I, you know, again, not being probably the biggest Pearl Jam enthusiast, but I've seen enough live stuff and solo stuff where you see someone like Tom York, who's just like playing all these like solo acoustic shows and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily what I, you know, see.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a songwriter and vocalist, but you don't think of him as typically having a guitar. You just know.
I don't. I think of him on the stage just like rocking the mic. And so. Rats.
Not to be confused with Rats by the Kinks on Lola versus the Power Man. This is not a cover.
Okay, good. Well, now that we got that out of the way.
Yeah.
Now this one does, I will say, to me, this has the most funk of any of the songs for myself. And it's mainly in that kind of that intro.
Funk is used very loosely. I mean, I didn't hear a clavinet in there, so elderly woman behind the counter in a small town, dude. Another interesting story, but again, told in a way that's not like linear or, you know, just but an interesting portrayal of somebody who just like never left. They just still work at the gas station.
Yeah, it really is. And it's kind of funny, man, because it's we talked a little bit about this in Wilco Sky Blue Sky and how that was very inspirational for Jeff Tweedy. Like the idea of God, you know, getting out of the town. Right. Mm-hmm. And everything. And it's funny to, you know, this is a very different you know, angle of that, but it's the idea of, gosh, I, you know, some people leave and some people don't, and some people, you know, get stuck and whatnot. And, I just thought, yeah, I thought it was, you know, one of my favorite songs on the album.
Yeah, for and sure.
One that did, you know, has gotten some radio play too. But yeah, the idea of, I think they were even saying, like, you know, it's this woman and she's stuck there, and like this guy she used to be with or something like comes back.
Yeah.
And, but he's changed, right? He's like,
yeah, for sure.
You know, and he doesn't even recognize her, and they have like this exchange or something. And yeah, it's a familiar story. And, you know, just something about the small town life has, in a weird way, it does have this romanticism to it, because it's kind of like this.
It's safety.
Just very compact universe.
Yeah.
Right.
It's safety.
And that's what it kind of is. So, yeah.
Leash.
Big fan of it, though.
Yeah, me too.
Leash.
I guess this was written about a relationship. Yeah. Yeah, they said that it was written about, there was a song on 10 written about the same
Wygo
person.
Yeah. So when I was kind of reading the lyrics, I was trying to figure it out. And yeah, it's definitely about a relationship and two people being in love. And I try to figure out like kind of what the leash was. And, you know, definitely, of course, everything's open to interpretation when it comes to this. But I almost looked at it as like they were kind of, you know, young lovers who were sort of misfits, because even one of the first lyrics of the song is, you know, troubled souls unite. But so they were kind of like outcast misfits. But maybe, you know, the leash was people or someone trying to sort of keep them apart, or that they shouldn't be together.
Oh, and it was like a Romeo and Juliet kind of scenario.
Yeah, you know, and kind of like the whole thing of, you know, drop the leash was just like, you know, just drop the leash and just let us be.
Yeah.
This is kind of the way I, you know, sort of interpret it.
Yeah.
But, you know, that again, you know, Eddie doesn't, you know, always paint a clear picture. So,
true.
Ed, what do you think?
Yeah. Tell us right after you.
Carl. Carl.
Yeah. last one, last dude. Track. Indifference.
Indifference. You know, so here's the thing with this one. A lot of times I say that a song like this is definitely slower. I think this song stands out on the album.
Oh, yeah.
And typically with a song like this, I'm like, oh, you know, you want to put this one towards the end. Maybe it doesn't have the energy. And sometimes it would maybe slow down the album a little bit, you know, almost to a halt if you put it sort of in the middle. You know, when I was listening to it again this time, there was a part of me that's like, you know, I almost maybe would have been okay with it being also in the middle. I don't know why, but I listened to it and there was something about it. There was some sorrow. There was some romanticism. Yeah. It had this calmness. But again, the way Eddie Vedder sings it, it had so much honesty to it.
Yeah.
That it didn't seem cheesy or any sort of cliche
no.
to it.
How much difference does it make?
How much?
That's what he says, man.
That's what he says.
So did you tell us what your favorite one is?
You know, I think for me, it is between two. It's probably, oh man, it's probably between Dissident and Daughter. Those two.
Just pretty much going with mainstream rock radio on this one.
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, dude, because I don't think. You know, I liked Pearl Jam growing up, but it was more, I will say, growing up, it was more radio Pearl Jam to me.
Dude, and so,
those are the songs that I knew and I was very familiar with. And man, yeah, dude, like I dug them. And, you know, it's really good to hear, you know, the other songs around these ones and actually in how different they are than those.
I would actually not call myself a super fan by any means. No. Dude, I've watched PJ20, really enjoyed it. Listened to most of their albums. But by no means a super fan, but I do understand what you're saying. I feel like I got into them more as I've gotten older. Like throughout the years, because I remember for some reason, I remember going back to this album freshman year of college.
Oh, yeah.
A lot. Okay. Yeah.
Cool.
I don't know why, but I remember that So what are you scratching?
All right. So I guess I'm first. I'm just numbing the T. So I think I'm actually going to scratch one of the songs that you really like. And that's actually going to be WMA.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I do like what the song is about, but I guess musically in the feel for it, it just doesn't really do much for me. And I could as easily go right into a song like Blood. So,
okay.
You know, so that's where I go with
well,
that.
Well, we're not going to OT.
Oh, no OT. Okay. What do you got?
Dude, for me, it's Leash.
Okay.
Leash just doesn't really do a whole lot for me. And dude, Elderly Woman could go right into Indifference. Cause
Indifference.
Just to end the album would have no problem with that.
Yep. I could definitely see that, man. Definitely.
And this person already had a song written about them.
Yeah.
You got your one. And it was on 10. I mean, you know.
Come on. Yeah. Ever heard of it? All right.
So I would say Versus is officially scratched.
Scratched. Well, we got to, you know, it'll be officially scratched. It's scratched by us, but we want it to be scratched by you.
Oh, so, yeah. Please do.
Everyone, please, you know, let us know what song you would scratch. It doesn't really bad sound. I don't like the song, but maybe there's one that you find yourself skipping from time to time, or it's one of the singles that was released and you've just heard it a million times and you're like, yeah, I'm good. I don't need to hear that song anymore. So we all have our choices. I would say no one will judge you, but everyone will judge you.
Oh, yeah. It's the internet. So, you know, people all of a sudden got balls.
Please feel free to tell us how crazy you are while you hide behind your screen.
Cool. Yeah.
All right.
And right after you go ahead, and, you know.
Yeah. All right, Graham. I think on that note, it's time to go. The Dude and
Grim Show. Scratch a Track is produced by the Dude and Grim. Additional music provided by More, that's .. MORE, and the Timms, TIMNZ. Copyright 2022, The Dude and Grim Show.